Welcome to Campfire, connecting primary producers. Campfire provides a solution-focused community for farmers and fishers to improve work systems and support mentally healthy workplaces.
For most farmers, climate's a variable that's part of the job. It's a risk that most try to minimise through planning. Climate change, though, is a considerably bigger variable. For some, it's a daunting prospect. G'day, I'm Drew Radford, and for some farmers, that's had debilitating impacts like stress, anxiety, and depression. That changed, though, in 2015 when a group of farmers met. They were concerned that climate change was not being acted upon by governments and a number of key stakeholders. The result was a movement that thousands have now joined, and it's helping shape the debate and also offer solutions. Along the way, it's also helped lessen some of the mental health impacts. One of those at that meeting was Charlie Prell, who's now chair of Farmers for Climate Action. And he joins us for this Campfire podcast. Charlie, thanks for your time.
Thank you, Drew. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Charlie, before we dive into the work that you do with Farmers for Climate Action, you're a farmer, first and foremost. Whereabouts and what do you produce?
I'm a sheep farmer, sheep and cattle, but mainly sheep farmer. My property's an hour and a half north of Canberra on the top of the Great Dividing Range, a little town called Crookwell, southern tablelands of New South Wales. I've lived there all of my life. In fact, I'm a fourth generation farmer, but I don't say that with any pride. I sometimes wonder whether the generational aspect of farming is one of the problems with agriculture.
Why do you say that?
We're living in times of extreme change in climate, but also in markets and social change. And generational farmers are very prone to staying with the systems that they've formed, the farming systems they've formed over two or three or four or five or more generations. I find the most enlightened farmers, not always, but generally, are farmers who have come into the farming world from the urban world, and we've seen a lot of that lately in the flight from the cities from the pandemic, that are open to new ideas and open to new systems and exploring new technologies and being open, I guess, is the basis of it.
Well, clearly this is important to you because I was having a look at the organisation's website and it says Farmers for Climate Action grew out of a meeting of frustrated farmers in the Blue Mountains in 2015. Many had spent decades voicing their concerns about climate change to no avail. They resolved to get to work. Can you elaborate on that frustration? How is that playing out in the daily lives of farmers?
From a farmer's perspective, the first 15 years of this century were dominated by the millennium drought that was very, very widespread with very, very small windows of rainfall and drought relief in between an extended period, 12 or so years of dry. On top of that, we had an endless political war over the merits of the debate about climate change, over the costs of action, not much talk about the costs of inaction. It was plain to me on the farm that things were changing, not in an annual sense, but in an underlying sense. And when you live on the land, you tend to get a feeling for how things are going on the land. You get in touch with the land, you get to pick animals when they're not so healthy or when they're sick. The land is the same as the animals. You get an eye for seeing that the land is really struggling. There was a general feel of nearly despair in that first meeting that you spoke about in 2015 when the drought had broken, but the political situation and the climate wars were at its peak at that time. There was a general feeling of despair in the room, and we didn't know whether we were capable of doing something, what we could do if we were capable of doing something, or whether we were going to make any difference at all. It's changed since then, but that was the genesis, and that the feeling in the room was, yeah, it was frustration. It was, when are our leaders, our supposed leaders, not just necessarily the farmers' leaders, but the political leaders across the board, going to get it that this is serious and we need to do something about it, not as a country or as a planet, but let's start with the country.
And Charlie, that sense of despair that you were seeing in producers in that room and the contacts you knew, what does that actually mean on a daily basis then? Is that anxiety? Is it depression? Or is it a range of things?
Well,
I'm not asking from a medical opinion, but, you know, just what you were seeing.
Well, from my personal experience, it meant depression. It meant anxiety, which was, in my case, panic attacks, which are frightening when you first get them and still frightening 6 years later when they're still occurring occasionally, not as powerfully as they were in the past. But also my wife had mental health problems. We were bringing up two children. We were bankrupt. We had to sell land to survive. We had to sell land not like it is today. We had to sell land and try and find somebody that wanted to buy it rather than argue over the price of the land. This is all through the lead up to this conference, and everybody at the conference were telling the same sort of stories. So the mental health was a huge impact on that aspect of that, because if you're in a bad mental health state, you're really, really struggling to make any good, either financial or farming or any other sort of decisions, future planning decisions. You're just trying to survive from day to day. At the same time, we were bringing up two teenage children, and that was tough. My two children have turned away from farming because of the angst that they saw and the pain they saw in their parents as they were growing up.
Charlie, thank you for being extraordinarily honest and upfront about that. And it gives a very important insight to what was really going on for a whole range of people at that particular time. And in that time, you choose to get involved in this meeting and you end up becoming chair. Was that also about trying to give back some sort of sense of control in a space that you didn't seem to have a lot?
No, I actually think it was more about, wow, this is the first opportunity I've seen for 10 years or more where I can actually make a difference and I can actually do something positive about all of these things that have been racking up on my back and driving me crazy at night so I can't sleep. It was about a change of mindset to a positive. I can do something to make a difference instead of just endless day after day slog that was obviously leading nowhere. At the same time, my life did change in other ways, but we can talk about that later. But to change your mental attitude is a journey. It's not a flicking a switch thing. And to get into a group of people who had the same problems that I had, but also were conscious enough and awake enough and motivated enough to sit down together and say, this is really bad. We've got to do something about this. This is a group of 40 people in a country of 20 million people. Just the vibe in that room was contagious and it was innovating, if you know what that means. It was energizing. It was like, I felt like there was no other course for my life to take than to get involved with these people and ended up obviously leading it. But that was a choice that I made because I love leading people. So within a couple of years, all of us, not the 40 of us, but probably the core 20 or so people from that group had turned their lives around, had formed an organisation that was going to become this organisation called Farmers for Climate Action that dominated our lives for a couple of years.
Clearly the sentiment there was contagious because there was 40 odd people there and 20 core members. But it's much bigger than that now, isn't it?
Just a little bit. We're representing over 7,000 farmers in Australia. And I shouldn't chuckle when I say that. We've grown extraordinarily. We're totally not-for-profit, so we're funded by philanthropists, whether they're large, small, and everything in the middle. 7,000 farmers, we think we're probably the largest agricultural representative group in Australia. Nobody's quite sure how many people are in the political parties because they don't divulge that information, but we're up there with the state farming organisations about the number of farmers that we represent. And managing that growth, for me, has been a really, really steep learning curve about governance and all sorts of things and being the public face of Farmers for Climate Action now after 5 years. I've been chair for the last 18 months, nearly 2 years. All of the people in the room, I mean, we've had plenty of disagreements and arguments along the way, but all of the people in the room had a common purpose, and that was not just to bring the climate debate into the real world in Australia so that we were debating realities, not fanciful flat earth society myths, but we also wanted to make sure that we were bringing people with us, and we also needed to make sure that we were attracting people with money that wanted to support our cause, because that's how we survive. We don't have a membership fee. It was a really, really exciting, sometimes scary journey to where we are today, where we're, you know, we're having meetings with Labor, Liberal, Green, National Party, independent politicians, and they're actually reaching out to us to say, how can we help? What are the priorities? If we're going to do something in the bush, how do we do it? What language do we use? Things like that.
Charlie, that's a remarkable story of growth and something to be very, very proud of. And you've clearly got some lobbying clout there to go and have these discussions. How do you see this playing out with new farmers that are getting involved and how they're viewing their world and their mental health?
It's a bit like when you go to a concert or a theatre production or a sporting match that's, you know, that's really tight. There's a lift in the energy, especially in a sporting context where there's two teams, but both teams' supporters are energised. And we're in a contest here against the fossil fuel industry, basically. And my side of the contest is a really attractive, energised place for people who actually want to do something about climate, who have realised that there's an urgency to tackle this problem. For them to have us as a peer group, to have my experience as a farmer and a leader over the last 5 years available to them, but also for them to be able to connect with other people in their geographic area, to form peer groups that exchange information and admit mistakes and applaud innovation. I don't get paid to do what I do, but I don't need to. I would pay to be in charge of watching people be so energised and come to the realisation that it's not asking the Prime Minister to do something or the leader of the National Party or the Liberal Party, whoever it is. It's actually possible for individuals to make a difference. And if four or five individuals in an area get together, they can make a massive difference, not just to their own little area, but to the well-being of the population generally. A little bit like the school strikes for climate, which started with one young student sat on the street with a sign that has turned into millions of young people getting together in a very, very non-confrontational way, saying, this is our future and you need to stand up and do something about it.
Charlie, in regards to doing something about it, could you briefly give a couple of examples how farmers are already adapting to the realities of climate change?
Well, let's start with my own personal story. There's a massive opportunity in Australia to become a superpower. We have the best renewable energy resources on the planet, and we have the opportunity to become the new energy superpower. We can become the Middle East of the oil age in this new energy future that I'm talking about, if we are brave enough to tackle that future. So that means that farmers and communities where, like the one where I live, need to be encouraged to build renewable infrastructure, whether it's solar panels, wind turbines, big batteries or mini pumped hydro storage, all those facets of renewable energy will all be built in regional Australia. Renewable energy now is the cheapest form of energy generation on the planet, and it's getting cheaper and cheaper and cheaper every day. All of that stuff will be built on farms because that's where the space is, and there's no competition between agriculture and renewables. It can all be done in a complementary way, not a competitive way. That is the most exciting aspect of this new future for agriculture in regional Australia. Secondly, we need to re-establish biodiversity and healthy soils in this country, including trees. To do that, we need to firstly tap into the wisdom of the Indigenous people who've lived here for tens of thousands of years, instead of turning our backs on them and ask them how they managed this place for 60,000 or more years. But secondly, we need to recognise and admit that we actually haven't done a very good job over the last 250 years of managing the landscapes in this country. But there's all sorts of opportunities arising through different regenerative agricultural practices, multi-species cropping, having large mobs of animals in small paddocks and cell grazing, waterway, water catchment management, so fencing off waterways and putting in troughs so that the animals are not impacting on the health of the water systems. all sorts of new innovative agricultural systems, which is a little bit back to the future, but that's okay. We're refining systems as we go.
Charlie, in that meeting in 2015, I imagine your ultimate objective was to make the group redundant, i.e. we've achieved what we wanted to achieve. But I understand you've just actually reviewed your strategic plan, because sadly that hasn't happened, and you've made some important changes in terms of your local community focus. What are they and why do they matter?
It's not sadly that we've had to review our strategic plan and stay alive. We initially thought, yeah, we would be hopefully be effective enough at combating the climate wars and shifting the politics to make ourselves redundant. But we pretty quickly realised that there's nobody out there providing the service that we're providing to other farmers, which includes all sorts of very, very up-to-date, competent scientific knowledge about the climate and the weather patterns and what's happening with climate change. It includes exploring different farming systems. It includes becoming more resilient in the face of the changing climate would be encapsulating the whole thing. But it's not a bad thing that we're still here. We're actually moving into a field of extension sort of work rather than advocacy work. We still do the advocacy work, obviously, because we want to change things at a political leadership level in this country, not just with politicians, with agri-political organisations and state farming organisations, etc., and politics as well, obviously. But we're finding there's a real need for self-sustaining small groups of people who can take their message to field days or to webinars or to small groups in country halls. And in a non-threatening environment, they can have conversations with people who are starting to be interested in what the hell is this all about, that might have not been awake to the whole climate dialogue over the last probably 20 years in this country, but at least the last 10.
Charlie, lastly, what do you see as the most helpful mindset as farmers strive to overcome stress and uncertainty of changing climate?
The biggest change for me, instead of just being overwhelmed by the magnitude of the challenge and the threat of climate change or the weather systems or life in general, whatever it is, if you're alone, it is overwhelming. But if there's even two people, but if there's a small group of people who can share their stories and their experiences and then their potential solutions, that creates a whole new positive mindset in all of those people in that group. And that becomes a virtuous cycle. It becomes a really positive learning space. It's similar to the Landcare organisations. And the main thing Landcare offers to people is information sharing in a really safe, positive environment. So moving forward rather than being stuck in the past. And the only way you can do that is to stand up to challenges and address them. And then all of a sudden, the opportunities that are there when you address challenges become apparent. If you're turning your back on the challenge and treating it as a threat that you can't do anything about, then you can't see those opportunities that arise if you face the challenge and look for innovative solutions like the renewable energy stuff I talked about earlier.
Charlie, you've certainly found those innovative solutions, and thank you for being so honest and upfront about the journey that you've been on and the amazing journey that it's become for literally many thousands of farmers. Charlie Perrell, Chair of Farmers for Climate Action, thank you so much for taking the time and joining us for this Campfire podcast.
It's my pleasure, Drew. I'm happy to talk to anybody anytime about farming, climate change and mental health.
Thank you for listening to the Campfire podcast. For more information regarding Campfire, please visit the National Centre for Farmer Health website. All information is accurate at the time of release. This podcast was developed by the National Centre for Farmer Health and is funded by the Victorian State Government's WorkSafe, WorkWell Mental Health Improvement Fund.